Hi, Patrick here, with some Chinese words that seem kind of ordinary. A word for river, a word for wheat, a word for kindness. But in certain contexts, they're anything but ordinary. Those Chinese words. In one case, they're words that the Chinese government doesn't want you to search online. In another case, they're words that the US government allows you to use. If you're running for office in California, you can give yourself any Chinese name you like. Any name.
Right now, it's the Wild Wild West. And if you want to say that my name means giver of millions of dollars in profits to local governments, then one could list your name on the ballot that way.
Also, it's official. Fiction is good for you. And the people of the world's newest country, South Sudan, are learning their new national anthem.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Violiner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. Rawr. New words, old words, censoring everything.
The World in Words and the World Radio Program, The Big Show, they're both productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. You can find us online at theworld.org. You can find this podcast online at theworld.org/language. That's where you can find my blog posts that accompany each podcast. They're also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is patrickcox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X. And there's a World in Words Facebook page where a lot of people post their comments. Today, unsearchable words in China. Well, I say unsearchable. You can search for as many words as you like. I mean unsearchable online. You can't, for example, get any results, famously, if you search with the word Tiananmen. But what's wrong with a word that means river? Then more Chinese words in California, words that make up the names of candidates, as in when an American political candidate assumes or takes a Chinese name. In other words, that candidate may seem to be Chinese when he or she isn't, which may deceive Chinese-American voters who may not speak English. Then proof, sort of, that reading made-up stuff, fiction, is good for you. And finally, the languages and the new national anthem of South Sudan. First up, the latest set of words that you can't search on the web in China. And all of this concerns former Chinese president Jiang Zemin, who's pretty old. On July 1st, there was a big party for the Communist Party of China, the 90th anniversary of the founding of the party, and Jiang didn't appear. That raised a lot of alarm bells as to the state of his health. There were already rumors that he was in bad health, but it was only after that non-appearance that rumors began that he'd actually died. Now, me here sitting in a studio in Boston, I have no idea what kind of state Jiang is in. But it's quite clear that his handlers in Beijing want to be in control of the situation. Here, speaking with Marco Werman, is The Big Show's correspondent in Beijing, Mary Kay Magstad.
This particular set of rumors started very late Tuesday night in Beijing. The media that first went with the story that Jiang Zemin had died were a couple of media sites that are linked to the spiritual sect Falun Gong, which is banned in China. And those sites are not always the most accurate when it comes to what's going on in China. However, there appeared to be a little more credibility to the reports when they came out in Hong Kong, both from Asia TV and TVB. And Asia TV is known to have relatively close links to the party. However, they went with a report earlier in the evening that Jiang had died and said that they were going to run a special report at 9:30 p.m. But when 9:30 came around, they instead ran a South Korean soap opera.
Mary Kay, I understand that one hint that something was up was that certain words were no longer searchable online. Explain that.
Well, what actually happened, it's hard to know which came first, but I think the rumors came first, and then censors stepped in and said, okay, you're not going to search for the word Zheng, which is, of course, Zheng Zemin's surname, but it also means river. So that makes it difficult to search for the Chinese name for the Yangtze River, which is Changjiang. It also comes up, obviously, in many other contexts, so it's a little bit inconvenient. There were also blockages for words like heart attack, party secretary, and of course for Jiang Zemin's name. If something like this were to happen, and we don't know that it has, the party likes to control the story. I was here in China in the 90s when Deng Xiaoping died, and the story was released at 2 a.m. There had been rumors, there had been concerns, and it wasn't floating around the way that this rumor has been because there wasn't the kind of internet reach that there is now in China. But the party decided to release the information and go, you know, full bore with memorial tributes on television, radio, and newspapers starting at 2 a.m. And if Jiang Zemin has died, they will release the information when they're ready to.
You know, I know how the Chinese government can be very protective of information, but why control the story of the death of a former president, especially if it is true?
Because, again, Jiang Zemin is the party's guy. They want to be able to be out in front of the story. They would actually probably consider someone getting in front of them on the story to be a leaking of state secrets, which makes it even more puzzling that two Hong Kong media went ahead and reported it. The party is just very control happy. When there's a story like this, these are their iconic leaders. Even if Jiang Zemin isn't quite on the level of Deng Xiaoping or Mao Zedong, his three represents thought is one of the pieces of philosophy that Communist Party members study. And the Communist Party wants to control the narrative whenever a leader like this passes on.
Mary Kay Magstad, the world's Beijing correspondent. Mary Kay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Okay, over now to California, where you can do any old Google search that you like. You can also call yourself anything you like if you're running for office. You could, I suppose, call yourself Jiang Zemin, though I'm not sure if that would help with getting votes. The reason all of this is pertinent is because California is home to the largest Asian American population in the nation, and nearly a third of Asian American voters in California are not proficient in English. So, come election time, the candidates end up appealing to those voters for their votes, not in English, but in their native Asian languages. And the feds have been helping out here. By law, in districts with sizable linguistic minorities, election materials must be translated. And those election materials include the ballots themselves, on which the names of candidates appear. But what the law does not specify is how all of this is translated. The feds have left it up to the states to figure that out. Now, some states have figured that out. They've passed laws regulating how these things are translated, and there are all kinds of rules for what a candidate can call him or herself in a foreign language, but not in California, which is why state lawmakers right now are trying to write some regulations. Here's Nina Porzuki.
5 years ago, candidate Mike Eng opened up his sample election ballot and...
when I saw how my name was spelled after someone told me about it, I literally almost fell out of my seat.
Eng was running, successfully it turned out, for a seat in the California Assembly. About 40% of his district is Asian American. And not just the ballots, but the official sample ballots that get mailed ahead of time have to be translated under federal law into four Asian languages: Chinese, Japanese, Vietnamese, and Korean. So when Eng was asked if he wanted his name translated onto the ballot, he thought, well, of course.
And to my surprise, because I don't read Chinese, it turned out that they had translated my name literally, Michael Eng, into what in Chinese sounded like Michael N. And if you read that literally, it actually translates to wheat can be kindness, which of course doesn't mean anything.
When Chinese characters are strung together to create phonetic transliterations of Western names, they can sometimes turn into pretty nonsensical sayings, like, well, wheat can be kindness. But it turns out Eng, who is Chinese American, also has a Chinese name, one that was given to him at birth by his grandparents.
My name in Mandarin is Wu Guaqing, and my name in Cantonese is Ng Gokhen.
His Chinese name has nothing to do with wheat, or kindness for that matter, but means pride of our national day. This is the name used by the Chinese media, the name that many voters knew him by, so Eng ended up spending the rest of his campaign telling voters
that this person whose name sounded like wheat in Chinese was actually me.
Despite the confusion, Eng won the election, but the situation still bothers him. Unlike English, written Chinese is based on meaning and not sound. And you might think Eng is hung up on the fact that his name meant wheat, but meaning is a big deal in Chinese writing, says lexicographer David Prager Branner. Take his name David. In English, no one really thinks about what it means. But when he uses his Chinese name, Dou Wei, the meaning is right there.
If I write my name Dou Wei, I am writing the word that means sort of virtuous inner strength, and the word that means the power to awe. These words, these characters, they're used. They're part of normal language. So meaning is right in your face with the Chinese writing system. You can't escape it.
Under the Voting Rights Act, certain jurisdictions are required to provide minority language assistance. This means translated materials, ballots, signs, bilingual poll workers. But the federal law is silent about name translation. Some states regulate how names appear on the ballot in character-based languages like Chinese, but not California. In California, the rules change from one jurisdiction to the next. Assemblymember Mike Eng's situation was unfortunate, but by no means the most extreme example of a name change. Some candidates may even have used this gray area of the law to gain favor with Asian American voters. In 2010, someone named Lei Jingping ran for San Francisco Superior Court judge using this TV ad.
Lei Jingping, Josie Lim Jing.
But that wasn't his birth name.
Nohai Michael Nava, Lei Jingping.
Yep, Lei Jingping was candidate Michael Nava. Lei Jingping is a very Chinese-sounding name, and a good one for a judicial candidate. It means correct and fair, an attractive Chinese name for Michael Nava to have chosen.
Right now, it's the Wild Wild West.
Again, Assemblymember Mike Ng.
And if you want to say that my name means giver of millions of dollars in profits to local governments, then one could list your name on the ballot that way.
Eng isn't alone in worrying about this issue. California State Senator Leland Yee has introduced a bill about how candidates' names are translated into character-based languages.
I think all of us, want good-sounding names that would engender warmth with the Chinese vote. But I think that when you do that solely for the purpose of gathering that vote and nothing else, then I think it's a little unfair.
A version of the bill was vetoed in 2009 by then-Governor Schwarzenegger, who declared that individual jurisdictions should decide this matter on their own. But Yee reintroduced it this year. It's critical, he says, to create one uniform policy to protect the integrity of the vote.
If Chinese Americans all of a sudden think that the voting process is a sham and that politicians are just simply trying to trick them, they're less inclined to participate in the electoral process.
Dean Logan is the registrar of voters in Los Angeles County. Under the proposed law, he would have to decide on which translations to use. He's uncomfortable with that.
It's an appropriate role for someone, and I think it needs to happen. I'm just not sure that that having that be the role of the registrar gets you to where you want to be with this, because I think you could ultimately still have somebody then turn around and challenge that in court, which further delays the process.
It's somewhat surprising that California, with its large Asian American population, lags behind other states like New York, where policy about candidates' names has been in place for well over a decade. But that may change in the next few months. Assemblymember Eng certainly hopes so.
Your name is your identity. Your name is your heritage. Your name is your family. Your name really is something that you can be proud of. And I look forward to the day where we can actually have a ballot that does really reflect the true identity of those that are running, because that's better democracy.
That may be the case when he runs for re-election. If the bill makes it to Governor Brown's desk and he signs it into law, then Assemblymember Eng will have to bid farewell to his doppelganger friend, Wheat Can Be Kindness. For the world, I'm Nina Porzuki.
I suppose you could say some of those foreign names were, made up, fiction, words of imagination. Well, guess what? Fiction is good for you. Wholesome, maybe not always, but it has value. I know it has value. I don't really know why it has value, apart from, I just have this vague belief that it keeps me sane, insofar as if I don't have a novel or a short story on the go, along with all of the nonfiction that I also read, I have to read, I get anxious. I need fiction. And I know this is a view that many other people have, however unscientific it may be. Well, who'd have thought? Somebody has tried to make that view a bit more scientific, or at least test it. That someone is Keith Oatley. He's a cognitive psychologist and a novelist, and an emeritus professor at the University of Toronto. He's written a book called Such Stuff as Dreams, The Psychology of Fiction, in which he tried to figure out the effect that reading made-up stuff has on us. He told the BBC's James Naughtie what he did.
I work with a small research group. What we tried to do is to take these assumptions and turn them into questions. In what way might it be true that fiction is good?
And what conclusions did you reach? I mean, what did you find? What surprised you and what just confirmed? Because after all, I mean, the Greeks knew that that was the case.
They thought it was the case.
Yes. Okay. Have you proved that it is the case?
Well, proof is, I think, something that goes on in algebra or courts of law, right? So what we did was started to do some studies. The first one was to measure the amount of reading that people do, and in particular to measure the amount of fiction reading and non-fiction reading, and then look to see whether the amount of fiction reading was related to how well people understood others, their degree of empathy with other people. I mean, it was his...
Their general kind of social awareness
We've got some rather specific tests of how to do that, but really it's actually understanding people and how empathetic one can be.
So what was the conclusion about the link?
Well, the more fiction you read, the better you are at this. And, of course, this is slightly counterintuitive because people think of bookworms as, you know, going off and avoiding social interaction.
But actually reading helps you to open yourself out to the world.
Exactly. Well, in particular, the social world. The way we think of it is that fiction books, novels, short stories, movies are something like a flight simulator. So if you were learning to fly a plane, you would spend some time perhaps in a flight simulator because there you would encounter a whole lot more situations in different ways than you would just pottering around.
Well, you're living with other people.
Yes.
You're living a rich life or an interesting life, maybe a depressing life, outside your own.
Yes.
Therefore, it's bound to increase your experience, isn't it? Or your second-hand experience of the world.
Yes, exactly. And so what we found is that spending some time in this way, or the more time you spend, actually the better you are at understanding other people. And given that the social world is somewhat difficult to navigate, this was...
This is a reassuring bit of research, because I'm sure people listening will say, well, you know, we've always known that, but in such stuff as dreams, the psychology of fiction, I mean, you've actually demonstrated that there is a positive effect on the way people cope with the world by the extent to which they read.
Yes, that's right, that's right. And so we're quite pleased with that. I didn't think that would come out, but it
did. You feared it mightn't, but you're happy that it
has. Yes.
Excellent. Keith Audley, author of Such Stuff as Dreams, thanks very much indeed.
Finally today, let's tip our hats to the world's newest nation, South Sudan. Things are a bit frantic there right now. Ever since January, that was when the South Sudanese voted in a referendum. They overwhelmingly voted to secede from the rest of Sudan. Ever since then, there's been a stream of people moving to South Sudan from the north, especially from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. I'm going to play a piece of tape from Susan Magwundu. She's the principal of the John Garang International School in Juba, which is the South Sudanese capital. She's very much at the forefront of dealing with this migration of people, at least the children, because there's a language gap in the schools. The language of instruction in most of Sudan is Arabic, but in South Sudan, it's English. Here's Susan Magwundu.
That was quite the most difficult issue that we faced. It was quite discouraging because you try to tell them even good morning, they didn't have that word. They all could speak only Arabic. And it was so hard for us to begin with them. But they had come back home and they wanted to get their education from Southern Sudan.
Now, just because English is the language of instruction in South Sudan, in fact, the only official language, it doesn't mean that other languages aren't spoken. In fact, this is a highly linguistically diverse place. There's Arabic, there's something called Juba Arabic, which is derived from a pidgin, mixing Arabic and various local languages. And among the local languages in South Sudan, there's Dinka, there's Mundari, there's Kakwa, and the list goes on. There are dozens of them. And there is, of course, now the matter of teaching the South Sudanese their new national anthem. There are people like this woman whose job it is to travel around the country right now teaching kids and adults the new national anthem. Still got a bit of work to do there. This guy's up for it, though.
We in South Sudan here, we are ready. I want to sing my national anthem so that I will see my flag going up.
Well, here's some of the national anthem coming up. It actually sounds pretty difficult to sing. It is all in English, and it has some of the usual buzzwords associated with national anthems. Though just imagine singing for the very first time as citizens of a new nation words like motherland and liberty. See you next week.